Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson from Bush Telegraph. Your chosen program is coming shortly, but you might also like to try the Bush Telegraph podcast for stories from rural and regional Australia. We look at topical stories and tales of life in the bush. You'll find us on the RN website.
Welcome to winter. This week, Sydney was nearly as cold as Rome in spring, and Canberra turned to frost. Time to think more about energy and other sources, say, deep within the earth. And what about fracking? This science show starts in another cold place high in the mountains of Afghanistan, where you wouldn't imagine anyone is giving much thought to science teachers. After all, it's hard enough training and keeping good ones in Australia. But Afghanistan? So meet a researcher at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. This is Dr. Nulia Salehi. If you think it's bloody hard trying to get anything done in your hometown, try this.
I am an Afghan Australian. And I traveled after 32 years in 2002 back to Afghanistan, where I saw the destruction and people without any shelter, without food and without any job.
Tell me about the woman you saw living between the boxes.
The first day that I arrived in Kabul, so I started walking and I wanted to see what happened during the time that I was absent. And I saw a woman, it was winter time, sitting with two children. So I asked her about her life and why she was there at 7 degrees. And she told me that she left her village because she lost her husband and she was seeking for shelter. And she didn't find anything, so she was living between two car doors.
Two cardboard boxes?
Yes. So
In the cold like that. Freezing cold.
Yes. And all they had, it was a patchy blanket. I bought a few blankets for them and a few things, basic things for them. And then when I started walking more and more in Kabul area, I saw more women and that they left their villages thinking that they go to the city and maybe they find a better life. But the life was really difficult for them.
What could they do? What could they seek?
They were seeking for job. They thought if they go to the city, maybe they find something and they get protection, but unfortunately, nothing existed.
It's a war zone, I suppose.
Everywhere, the same.
But this is not the best place to try to go to teach people science and maths, is it?
Well, I think it is the best place to go and teach science. The Afghanistan today, they have 7.3 million students. They are going to school, but the level of education is really low. And they need 140,000 science teachers around Afghanistan. And they haven't got it. So in 2006, I started my project on science teacher training. In 2007, I signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the Ministry of Education to train their science teachers. So since then, we trained 1,700 teachers for them. I could do more, but there's no money. All I do, I come to Melbourne, I beg and take the money and just run one project after another. It is really difficult when I know that Western countries, including Australia, they gave so much money to Afghanistan, but the money didn't reach Afghanistan.
How do you teach science teachers? How is it done?
The Ministry of Education is choosing the trainees for us. The first day when they come, they sit for a test. Our project takes 220 hours. And also they do a lot of practical work. Some of them, they finish their degrees at the university, but without any practical work. So they need that to make the science something interesting for the students. And now they do it.
Give me some examples of some of the young teachers you've met.
An example of one school that they're sending always their teachers to us. This year, 2 weeks ago, I was in Kabul and I went to monitor their projects and to see the students and talk with them. And the principal of the school said, you know, I had 162 students at year 12. They finished their VCE and 72 of them have been received by the University of Kabul. They passed their exams. And five of them had the scholarship to go to Turkey. And the highest achievement was in this school. So because we trained all of their science teachers.
Well done. That's so extraordinary. But why would children in Afghanistan want to take on science and maths? Because it's hard enough here in Australia.
Afghan people, as I know, boys want to become engineers and girls to become doctors. But the opportunity is not there. They need more education. They need financial support to reach somewhere. They're very intelligent boys and girls. So if we help them, if we spend our money in capacity building in Afghanistan instead of spending the money in missiles, so
guns.
We get somewhere with these children. They will be the future of not only of Afghanistan.
So there's plenty of work for them to do for doctors and engineers in Afghanistan.
Yeah, there is. There is a need for engineers and doctors. There is no need for unskilled, uneducated people that they have nothing to offer for the rebuilding of their country. It's why we created carpentry training. So through the carpentry, we train young boys and they all found jobs. And then we have another project, Life Skill for Women. So we are going to the rural area, to the villages that nobody wants to walk there, and train women basic literacy, basic health, and providing them more information about their rights.
It's presumably not a lone quest of yours. Do you have many helpers in Australia here?
There are, in our committee of management, we have only 8 people working together. So
all scientists like yourself?
No, all well-educated people, not scientists. But we are working together and we are trying to get something for Afghan children and Afghan women.
Tell me a final question. What sort of help would you like to have from listeners who are tuning in to the Science Show
around the world? I love to build an institute in Afghanistan, a science institute, that the people, they learn more about science and technology. And they get wonderful, well-educated teachers for Afghanistan.
So, Dr. Nulia Salehi is Executive Director of the Afghan-Australian Development Organisation, and she is a senior scientist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. Well, on Friday, the Australian Academy of Science ran a full-day seminar on this country's future energy needs, Power for the People. Yes, the usual smorgasbord with signs of progress for the doubtful. One of the speakers was Sir David King, former chief scientist in Britain. Here he is speaking rather more generally at the Academy dinner on Thursday night.
When I became chief scientific advisor, you've got to imagine this. I am a physical chemist. I'd been working in the research lab with amazing young research students all my career, nearly 40 years, and then suddenly you're offered this post in government. And it was like stepping into a room with no lights on. I had no idea what was involved. And the very first thing that happened to me was the world's biggest foot and mouth disease epidemic. And as a physical chemist, I can tell you I couldn't even get the word epidemiology across my lips. So it was to be serious for a moment, a discovery of the unity of science. Because the models for following a virus traveling from one farm to another, the mathematics was very similar to models I had published in the 1980s on the diffusion of molecules on solid surfaces. So it was really rather a pleasure to work with a bunch of epidemiologists and find that I could not only understand what they were doing, but also challenge. And the role of chief scientific advisor is precisely that, to bring in the top experts, challenge them, distill it down, and then give clear advice to government. Now, in that foot and mouth disease outbreak, what we did was model, and then we introduced a new mode of containing the epidemic. And it was considered to be very draconian by many, and I got heavily criticized in the media, and becoming media savvy was the first part of the job. We had exponential growth in our epidemic in terms of the number of farms that were infected. And by the time we'd finished our modeling, working 24/7, we had something like 45 new infected farms reported every day. And I simply went into the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and I said, we could actually turn exponential growth to exponential decay within 2 days. Now, this was a Prime Minister in a bit of a flurry, because every newspaper knew that he was planning to go to the country for a general election on the 5th of May that year. And our graphs were showing that the epidemic was going to be at enormous proportions on the 5th of May. And no one else had indicated how this might be brought under control. So suddenly I was put in charge of the entire operation, including, and this is what prime ministers and government ministers do, putting the white coat onto television and radio. Now, of course, I knew that it was my head on the block. If it didn't work, then the chief scientific advisor would be gone tomorrow and the prime minister would stay. I was fairly confident about what we were doing. And as we passed that peak 2 days later, with this rather draconian policy in place, the prime minister said to me, please tell me when you're confident that we're on your exponential decay curve. And so a week later, I went into him. I was seeing him twice a day through this period. I went into him and I said, Prime Minister, I'm pretty confident now. And I showed him the graphs. And this, I believe, is probably the only occasion in which a Prime Minister has chosen a date of election on the basis of a computer printout from our prediction on the epidemic. Right, so when the epidemic on a linear plot dropped to one new farm a day, it looked like it was over. So he called the election for June the 6th. And that was based entirely on looking at that plot. It worked very well. He was re-elected. Before the foot and mouth disease epidemic, we'd had another problem with our farms. The first was the well-known BSE crisis. And that was not handled too well by government ministers who were very, very keen to see that Britain would keep selling beef. That was the prime target. And so when you get a minister going on television feeding his daughter with a hamburger made from freshly minced cow meat, you can see just how bad this was getting. This was a major problem when I came into government, because the trust of the public in the scientific establishment was what was put to blame. And I had to take a very simple mantra, which Tony Blair, to his credit, accepted at least at the beginning, which was, I tell you what my advice is, and then I put the advice always into the public domain, whatever your decision is, whether you act on it or not. And that was a means of getting public trust back. Now, BSE is very, very similar to scrapie and sheep. It's extremely difficult, actually, scientifically, to distinguish the two. And so a very real question was suddenly asked, which is, are the sheep that are falling over with scrapie actually all falling over with scrapie? Or has BSE gone into the sheep population as well? And so we sent off samples of sheep brain to a range of scientists around the world. It took them 7 years to come back with the results. This was a difficult challenge. And when the results came back, it was very, very clear that BSE was present in sheep brain. So what I was sitting with this information was a red button on my desk, which meant death to every sheep in Britain. This was quite a terrible potential decision. So I called all these experts from around the world to sit with me for a day. And during the period, I simply said to them, what was the chance that the sheep brain samples, sheep brains were all chucked in a bucket, minced up, and samples sent around the world, that the sheep brain samples had been contaminated with beef brains or with the blood from beefs in the abattoirs from which they were collected. And they all said, no, every brain was carefully washed, etc. Well, it turns out that I was the only one asking the question, and has anyone done a DNA test? Nobody had conducted a DNA test. So I sent samples to the laboratory for the government chemist, and the LGC director called me up and said, I hope you're sitting down. And he said, those samples that you sent us are 100% bovine. there was no contamination from sheep brain in the samples that were sent. Now, what had happened was buckets of the two lots of brains had been collected from abattoirs, and the buckets had been labeled LG/5/53 and LG/5/52, and somebody had muddled them up. So for 7 years, the wrong brains were tested, and it was correctly proved, good for the scientists, that they had BSE. So Lord Sainsbury, who was the science minister, said to me, "You've probably just saved the country about £10 billion with this decision to do the DNA test." The test was subsequently, of course, continued, and it turns out that our sheep hadn't picked up BSE. Well, if I then say a little bit about energy, because climate change was always going to be at the top of my agenda, and my agenda kept getting swept aside by these other issues. Fusion was mentioned earlier on, and I decided to make a big push for fusion because I believe that there is a potential for creating energy into the future from lithium and deuterium, which can continue for thousands of years. And so a potential solution on a very large scale to the energy stroke climate change problem. In the middle of this, I went in to see the Prime Minister, who said to me, "I'm confused. What is the difference between fusion and fission?" And Tony Blair, to his credit, would sit there and listen carefully as I described the difference. And he would want to know, "So how come you combine two atoms and you get energy, and you split an atom and you get energy?" And then I knew he was beginning to get the answer. It took me about 40 minutes, and then, as usual, the barrister in him, he would then say, "Fine, I've got it. Let me see if I..." He wouldn't take any notes, and he just gave me back in 20 minutes what he'd just learned. 3 months later, I've got to give you the key to this story. So I had been into the United States, Secretary for Energy, trying to persuade them to join the International Fusion Program. And the answer came back negative. The undersecretary was a person I got on with very well, and he said, "There's only one way to do this, and that's to persuade your prime minister to tell our president that he should do it." So 3 months after I'd briefed him on fusion, Blair called me up, it was a Saturday night, and said, "I'm just getting in a plane to go to Camp David. I'm going to raise fusion tonight. Can I just take you through the fusion story again?" And he repeated it almost word for word. This is a man with a remarkable memory. It was a few weeks after he came back before I saw him, and I was very anxious, of course, do we have America on board or not? And so when I saw him, he said, "Well, do you want the good news or the bad news first?" And so I said, "Well, give me the bad news." And he said, "Well, the bad news is that..." I started saying to George next to the fire after dinner, "Let me tell you about fusion. It's really fascinating." And George said, "Forget that." He said, "I don't want to hear about it. Are you for or against?" And Tony said, "Well, I'm for." And he said, "Here comes the good news." George said, "Fine, we're in." After persuading the British government that climate change was a major challenge, and really a major challenge to the British Isles, we're faced with flooding risks, both from fluvial flooding, changes in rainfall pattern, and from rising sea levels. And in Parliament, actually, when I presented maps of Britain and showed what it was going to look like in 2080 on the business as usual, there were parliamentarians who asked me not to put this into the public domain because their constituencies were going underwater. So the lesson I learned from this was that you have to show the threat and at the same time show solutions. Well, Blair said to me, "Fine, now you're going to spend most of the rest of your time travelling around the world persuading governments." There wasn't a minute when I wasn't a very, very busy person, and at the same time, in many ways, very rewarding. And the rewarding side of it, believe it or not, comes from sticking your neck out. So when I made that statement in the preamble to going to Seattle to deliver an opening address at the AAAS meeting, I published a paper in Science suggesting that climate change was more serious even than global terrorism. This divided the American population very clearly in two and led to a very difficult time with my prime minister. Let me say that I believe the difficult time came from the President of the United States, who thought that he could instruct our Prime Minister to get rid of his chief scientific advisor. But it did mean that I was no longer allowed into meetings with the President, and I was never allowed to accompany Blair even to the G8 plus 5 on climate change that I had been the generator of. So there can be difficult times as well as enjoyable, but I think the important thing as a chief scientific advisor, and I leave you with this, throughout your career in science, there is one thing you know that you have, and that is your scientific integrity. And if you go into a job in government, what you've got to make sure of is that you hang on to that come hell or high water. Thank you.
Sir David King, former chief scientist in the UK. And so to an overview of the Energy Conference at the Academy of Science on Friday. Here's Professor Tom Maschmeyer from the University of Sydney who organised it.
So coal basically puts a new spin on an old idea. So Rudolf Diesel came up with the idea of running an engine with coal dust and water. However, that coal dust was too mineral rich for the piston to survive. So he switched to peanut oil, and the rest is history, as they say. What we are going to showcase, together with the CSIRO and a number of other players doing this symposium, is that there is now Australian technology that is able to make very clean black coal from Australian brown coal, and that coal is then able to be burned with the same efficiency in terms of power generation per CO2 emitted as natural gas, or close to it.
How do you get it to become efficient when it's such a complex mixture of all sorts of stuff?
Well, it goes initially through a process called hydrothermal upgrading, where we convert it to oil as well as black coal, and that process takes out lots of the nasties, lots of the minerals and the sulfur. And once we've done that, we just rely on the diesel engine principles of taking all the gases that evolve during combustion and converting them to motion, which then converts to electric energy.
And what about what's left over?
Well, the remnants, of course, are CO2, but that happens every time you burn something fossil fuel. And then we have particles, diesel particles, but these are not a big problem because given that this will be a stationary application, they can be captured with known technology.
So it could be a major industry, in other words, on a large scale?
Given that we also produce oil as a side product, the value to Australia is in the trillions of dollars.
What about solar thermal? It seems to have been rather quiet, apart from in Spain, where they've got an amazing structure. What about the possibilities there?
Well, I'm a real admirer of solar thermal because it's so elegant, and I have personally great hopes that we will get that to go. Issues are, of course, infrastructure cost and investment time lag, but the principle itself is very, very attractive, and of course it is very renewable indeed once we get it going.
Essentially, it's heating up water direct from the sun, isn't it?
It's heating up a salt that can maintain the heat, and then that heat is released over time to, in fact, give us like baseload power, similar to what one gets from a gas or a coal power station.
And the salt stores, and that means you can have it as a kind of reserve permanently on tap.
Well, the salt stores for a period of 12 to 24 hours, and that energy is slowly released to get a reasonably even power supply.
And what stage of development is that technology?
There are a number of pilot plants around the world. The Australian Solar Institute, that's now become ARENA, has put in $120 million, and we are, I guess, a couple of years away from really having a commercial breakthrough.
Two of the stars, that's coal and solar thermal from the Academy of Science all-day seminar. Another example?
Another one is, of course, photovoltaic. That is a completely different idea, where one takes the solar light and converts it to electricity. The speaker will be Martin Green,
who's just become a Fellow of the Royal Society of London.
Congratulations, Martin. And he will be talking about silicon solar cells. And I believe the University of New South Wales has come up with a way of improving the efficiency by healing some of the defects with hydrogen in a very cost-effective way, pushing it yet to another world record of efficiency, another world record for Australia.
And that's one of the world records they've held for about 25 years.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Overlooking some of these innovations in energy, do you feel they're moving at such a pace that alternatives to the fossil fuels can be a credible option in the future?
I think the future, the next 20, 30 years, will definitely have a large proportion of energy that comes from renewables. Between now and 2050, the world is expected to double its need of electrical power. And we obviously want to decarbonize the electrical power that we are producing now. And if we have to double what we are producing now, you know, everything new we want to make renewable. Quite a heterogeneous picture.
Thomas Maschmeyer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tom Maschmeyer, Professor of Chemistry at the University of Sydney. So let's start with solar and our PhD for this week, doing work not in silicon, but print.
Hello, my name is Natalie Holmes and I'm funded by the Australian Solar Institute and I work at the Centre for Organic Electronics, headed by Professor Paul Dastoor. When most people think of solar cells, they may picture the flat, rigid structures made of silicon that they see on people's roofs. But there are other kinds. Organic solar cells are solar cells that utilise a special class of plastic, known as polymers. This class of plastic absorbs sunlight in the visible region and converts it into electricity. Organic solar cells offer a low-cost, renewable energy solution to the increasing global demand for energy. The material properties of the polymers enable the solar cell fabrication to be quite versatile. Solar cells can be printed from solutions of polymers, known as polymer inks. The ability to utilize conventional printing techniques enables the solar cells to be printed on a large scale, something not possible with the fabrication of silicon solar cells. This technique has the potential to reduce the cost of production substantially compared with silicon solar technology. Organic solar cells can be manufactured by printing onto flexible surfaces using roll-to-roll manufacturing, similar to the way newspapers are printed. Just imagine printing reels and reels of solar cells using inks, just as you would print newspapers. A disadvantage with printing these organic solar cells is that the polymers only dissolve in toxic organic solvents, such as chloroform. This means that to print on a large scale, chloroform-based inks are required. This is undesirable due to the environmental impact of chloroform and danger to workers. However, nanoparticle organic solar cells have now been developed that can be printed from water-based inks. This technology gets around the issue of solubility by fabricating nanoparticles that can be suspended in water rather than dissolved in chloroform. These nanoparticles are small spheres or balls of polymer. This is similar to suspensions that exist naturally, such as milk, which is a suspension of fat globules in water, stabilized by proteins. Our nanoparticles are stabilized by a surfactant or soap, which is very much like your common laundry detergent. To make a solar cell, you need to have a few layers of different materials, just like a sandwich. The first layer must be clear so that light can enter the solar cell, but it also needs to conduct electrons. So we start by coating a transparent electrode onto a sheet of plastic or glass. The next layer is the nanoparticles. We print a very thin layer of the nanoparticles using water-based nanoparticle ink. Then finally, we apply a top electrode. Now we have a working solar cell that is then encapsulated to protect the materials before being used outdoors. My PhD project involves developing this nanoparticle technology for commercial solar cells. Being an emerging area of research, the solar cell efficiencies are still quite low. But as we develop the technology and understand more about the process, efficiencies are improving. One of the key aspects to developing the technology is investigating the structural arrangement of nanoparticle layers and the effect this morphology has on the final solar cell performance. I travel to the Advanced Light Source, a synchrotron in Berkeley, California, each year to conduct experiments which investigate this morphology. It is important to make renewable energy more affordable. Currently, commercial solar cells are quite expensive, which may be one of the reasons why uptake of this technology seems to be slow. Organic solar cells have the potential to be manufactured at low cost due to their use of existing printing technology. This will help accelerate the uptake of renewable energy, something vital for an increasing world population that needs access to energy that can be produced without poisoning the planet.
Admirable thought. Dr. To Be, Natalie Holmes at the Centre for Organic Electronics, University of Newcastle, New South Wales. Meanwhile, under our feet, there's heat, enough to keep us going for centuries. There are hot rocks in South Australia, and there's the scheme for bringing up heat in the Latrobe Valley, where it lies under that great big blanket of brown wet coal. We've talked about this before on The Science Show on RN, and here's an update from Professor Rachel Webster, University of Melbourne, and Mike Sandiford, who heads the Institute for Energy there.
Well, the basic idea was to tap into what we believe may be an increased heat gradient below the coals in the Latrobe Valley, enabling us to reach reasonably high temperatures at depths that are not too great, maybe around about the 4 kilometre mark, and then to somehow capture and harness that energy to produce electricity.
And Mike, is it true that you would squirt CO2 down to bring the heat up?
Well, that's a possibility. CO2 would, in theory, be a good working fluid, and there's no shortage of CO2 in the Latrobe Valley, so it's one of those conjunction of events. Of course, separating that CO2 is a challenge in itself.
How would it stay down there rather than come up again?
If we're using it as a working fluid to extract geothermal heat, it needs to come up again, but you wouldn't be so concerned if you lost some of it in the reservoirs down there. That's more of a challenge if you're using water, because water is, of course, a precious commodity and we don't want to lose too much of it.
Well, Rachel, we talked about this some time ago. I was going to say years. This is a couple of years at least. What's happened since?
Well, a lot and not very much. So there's been a good deal of enthusiasm amongst the geothermal community, and we would probably say at this stage that we're moderately confident that the heat resources are in the Latrobe Valley and a number of other locations, the Cooper Basin. But the really critical issue is whether we can create, well, they usually call them reservoirs, of fractures in the rocks at suitable depth to allow the fluid to pass through. So that's really the difficult bit. We sometimes call that flow, you know, so whether or not the fluid will flow at those depths and therefore heat up and close a circuit that we can then tap into.
The reason it's there is because of the very insulating properties of coal. Coal is about 8 times more insulating than normal rock, so it traps heat underneath it. South Australian setting, we're looking at rocks which are rich in uranium naturally heating themselves under moderately insulating sedimentary rocks. So there's some similarities and some differences in the two settings. The Latrobe Valley is unique in having such vast thicknesses of brown coal. So in total, in places, the thicknesses are up to 300 metres. So that's a vast mass of insulating material. And we know that beneath those, at 600 metres in the hottest parts, the water temperatures are already 70 degrees. We need to probably go 3 or 4 more kilometres to get to the temperatures where you're able to produce electricity from those hot waters. But the challenge is getting down to those depths and working on. What's happened in geothermal across the country, of course, in recent times, is that geodynamics in the Cooper Basin has started to produce electricity, which is a significant achievement. It's been a long time in the making. A lot was promised to this technology, and it's taken a long time to get to the stage of producing electricity.
How much?
Well, it's got a megawatt plant, as I understand, which has been running now for a week or so, and they are going to run that for a month or so. Of course, there's not much use for that scale of electricity out in the middle of the Cooper Basin at the moment, but the challenge really is to demonstrate that we can deliver this type of electricity and understand how we can scale it up and deliver it in places where it's more useful. And of course, that's one of the challenges of the Latrobe Valley. It's already a part of the world which is well endowed with infrastructure that can deliver the electricity to where it might be needed.
Is it very complicated to transfer a power station from a heat source of just burning coal to a heat source that is energy coming from the ground?
Well, yes and no. You wouldn't convert a coal-fired power station. You wouldn't use the same turbines and stuff like that. You would purpose build. However, having said that, there's an idea that we've been investigating which is moderately promising, which is instead of using the heat to directly turn the turbines and generate electricity, we use the heat to preheat the fluid that goes into a coal-fired power station. So the basic idea here, and this is part of mitigating risk, is to reduce the amount of brown coal that you actually use in a brown coal-fired power station. And so we're working with some our colleagues at the University of Newcastle. We've recently completed a study trying to understand whether that makes economic sense to actually preheat water going into a coal-fired power station. And the results of our very preliminary study have been very promising. It certainly seems that this is an economic case that can be made, entails a lot less risk than essentially just going out and drilling a 4 kilometre hole and trying to generate electricity directly from that hole, although, as Mike says, it's now been achieved in the Cooper Basin.
And it speaks to a more general point that I think is important in understanding how we transition our energy infrastructure so we incorporate more and more low emissions technologies is how do we make use of already existing infrastructure along that route? How do we hybridise that infrastructure as we develop a confidence in the new technologies? And that's a challenge, but it also presents some opportunities rather than thinking about totally rebuilding the whole infrastructure, which would, of course, be an incredibly expensive thing to do. And the fact that electricity demand in Australia is falling makes building new infrastructure quite challenging.
Well, you know, there are some small schemes in Perth already operating. Is there anything operating in Melbourne at the moment?
There are a number of domestic installations which are commercially put in across the Melbourne district, but direct geothermal, where we're using the shallow temperature in the ground, the fact that it's warmer than the surface air temperature in winter and cooler than the surface air temperature in summer at depths of 3 or 4 metres, down to 50 or so metres, allows us to use that as a heat bank to do building air conditioning. That's a really great technology for large precincts. So we're trying to deploy that on the University of Melbourne campus. Ian Johnson, one of our civil engineers, has got a demonstrator running, and we'll certainly be factoring that into some of the new buildings we're trying to put there. Of course, an even bigger challenge is how do we do it appropriately for retrofitting existing buildings?
Isn't that going to be reasonably cheap, though, retrofitting?
The optimal design is to put these things into foundations and design them into the building from the start. That's the best way to do it. So, of course, then you've got to start with a new building to do that.
Well, there's a problem, Rachel. You've got feasibility studies going on, and, of course, applying the infrastructure is very costly. You've talked about the fact that the money is not sloshing around in its available state. And we've got all that immense amount of coal in the Latrobe Valley and elsewhere that we can just dig up cheaply. Is this what we're talking about, a long, long way off?
Well, I probably would say I'm a lot less optimistic now than I was a couple of years ago. I think it's going to take political will of governments to prime these sort of projects. I think it's unlikely that electricity generators will see this as a way forward in and of their own volition. So in other words, it's going to need a little bit of a kickstart from government funding. The budget wasn't too promising, but I think probably the best that we can do is to continue to try and find ways that demonstrate a strong economic argument for going down these routes. For example, if we were using direct heat to preheat the fluids going into the coal-fired power stations, in that process, we will learn a lot about how to manage the extraction of heat at depth. And I think the next stage after that then might be a direct electricity generation. So it's clearly going to be a multiple stage process. But, you know, even if we were able to reduce the carbon footprint of a Loy Yang power station by 20%, that would be a very big win.
There's a lot of learning by doing, and the real challenge has been to get to the place where you can start to learn. Fortunately, geodynamics has got there recently, and that's a big achievement. Even though it's a very small output, it's a big achievement. I think on the positive side, a lot of things are happening about how we deal with what's under our ground in our energy-rich sedimentary basins, which are encouraging us to think better about how we manage the resources under our feet. We can see this in the current debate around coal seam gas and how it impacts on groundwater. Our energy-rich basins, our sedimentary basins, provide us with a lot of services. They provide us groundwater, they provide us hydrocarbons, they provide us places to store our wastes. They're potentially useful for things like compressed air storage. We put natural gas in temporary reservoirs. We're increasingly using our underground in a multiplicity of ways, and as we do so, we need to understand the impacts of one use on current and future potential. That forces us to think about how we integrate our usage scenarios and manage basins under our feet so we don't produce unintended consequences. So we don't, for example, produce significant earthquakes, as has recently happened in Louisiana, where a magnitude 5.7 earthquake in recent years was attributed to injection of wastewater over a period of 20 years prior to that. These sorts of unintended consequences are issues that we need to manage. By learning how to manage, we will learn how to deliver new resources like, for example, geothermal. It's a big issue for us. We're seeing a lot of the politics around things like coal seam gas and interaction with groundwaters becoming quite heated and quite risky.
Dr. Mike Sandiford, who this week was elected a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Science, and Rachel Webster is Professor of Physics at the University of Melbourne. So what is happening with all that fracking and shale gas? Peter Hadfield reports.
It isn't often that environmental activists find themselves on the same side of an issue as talk radio host Alan Jones.
If this isn't a major issue facing this country, and if this isn't something that galvanises all Australians, including the media and politicians, then I'm simply saying Australia is in for a hell of a lot of trouble down the track.
You know that coal seam gas.
On the face of it, coal seam gas should be everyone's best friend. It burns much more cleanly and efficiently than coal, producing fewer greenhouse gases for the same amount of energy. Not only that, Australia has lots of it, and it's profitable. And according to Newcastle University hydrology professor Gary Wilgoose, often misunderstood.
I've given any number of talks, both to community groups and to technical audiences, and first of all, they don't understand the difference between shale gas and coal seam gas. And not surprisingly, they don't understand how the geology of those two different types of gas formations impacts on how the fracking works.
So let's start by differentiating between the two. Shale is made from mud, laid down millions of years ago and hardened into a flaky rock. Decaying animal matter and vegetation in the mud gave rise to the methane gas that's now being pumped out of the shale across large parts of the United States. Coal, of course, comes from swampy forests piled up and compressed over millions of years. The methane that accumulates in these underground coal seams is adsorbed onto the coal itself and kept there by water pressure. Coal seam gas is released when the water is pumped up and the pressure reduced. On the other hand, water has to be pumped down to extract shale gas, fracturing or fracking the rock to ensure maximum yield. Shale gas isn't exploited much in Australia, so fracking isn't widespread. According to a 2011 study by the Institute of Sustainable Futures in Sydney, only about 8% of the 4,500 coal seam gas wells in Queensland use the fracking process, although that figure is expected to rise as coal seam gas becomes more difficult to extract. Up until now, the public concerns have been focused on two main areas.
The first two concerns, I think, have been about land use and competing land use and have been about water. And those are really important issues.
Dr. Mike McWilliams is with the CSIRO in Brisbane.
And as people have become more aware of all the issues associated with unconventional gas production, then fugitive emissions have come more into the frame.
McWilliams is overseeing a CSIRO study on emissions of methane that don't get burned, those that escape into the atmosphere from coal seam gas wells. Until recently, these so-called fugitive emissions got barely a mention in the public debate, but they have the potential to undermine methane's credibility as a green alternative to coal.
The methane emissions are 21 times more intensive in terms of greenhouse warming potential than that for CO2. So if we discover that methane emissions are larger than some threshold amount, it may turn out that the greenhouse gas emissions produced by in gas production may possibly equal that of coal, and there are those who've argued that it's larger than that.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil can spill and bring a job to small town, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
The United States is where the technology for extracting coal seam gas was first deployed in the 1990s, but the measurement of fugitive emissions took a while to catch up. It was only last year that several studies were published showing sampling data from as far afield as Boston and Los Angeles. In a Colorado study, America's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration detected high concentrations of methane gas close to the Denver-Julesburg Basin, home to around 20,000 gas wells. The data suggested fugitive emissions of around 4% of production. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has its own national estimate, which doubled in 2011 to around 2.6%. In other words, out of 100 tonnes of methane produced, 2.6 tonnes are lost to the atmosphere. That doesn't mean the same figures apply in Australia, because of course shale gas production in the United States isn't comparable with coal seam gas production here. But the figures were a wake-up call to the fact that Australia lacks similar empirical measurements. Until now, official government estimates have been based on industry reporting, according to a formula for all natural gas extraction. That fugitive emissions figure is just 0.12%. Professor Wilgoose says making estimates without empirical measurements is a leap into the unknown.
I mean, you think about it, it's so hard because it's a function of a maintenance of a wells, you know, sort of, you know, if they're well maintained, there shouldn't be anything come out. Even if it's poorly maintained, it's probably okay, and it gradually increases over time. You know, there's damage in pipes, joints, and that sort of stuff. Nobody knows, I think. Right. That was why I thought the Southern Cross work was so interesting, is because for the first time, someone's driving around trying to get a bit of an idea of what the methane levels are.
The Southern Cross University research was conducted by Professor Isaac Santos and Dr. Damien Maher. They drove around the gas fields at Tara, west of Brisbane, with a methane detector, and in an as-yet unpublished study, they found high levels of methane compared to control samples outside the area. But the study suffers one obvious drawback, says Wilgoose.
It's always a problem with all of these things, is that if you don't have enough baseline before you start, and then you see something, the question is, well, was it always there? Or is this a cause of, for instance, the gas company or the coal mining company or, for instance, with methane, or is it the farmers? It's quite common for deeper irrigation wells to actually be a bit effervescent, as basically it is. It's just a bit bubbly.
The researchers have tried to get around the problem in a more recent published study by measuring a methane proxy, radon gas, as Professor Isaac Santos explains.
The paper we have so far that shows a significant relationship between the radon concentrations in the atmosphere and the number of nearby coal seam gas wells. So that makes us believe that the coal seam gas wells are related to radon. We found a threefold enrichment of radon in the gas fields relative to our control station just 10 or 20 km away. We are not expecting that massive change. Those results are very surprising.
Santos says radon makes a good proxy because it can only come from underground. It's a daughter element in uranium decay, and its short half-life means it's detected fairly close to source. But the CSIRO's Mike McWilliams is cautious about the results, arguing that radon hasn't yet been proved a reliable proxy of methane emissions. In April, a discussion paper was released by the Federal Department of Industry, Innovation and Climate Change, recommending more comprehensive and direct sampling of fugitive gases. The department is working with the CSIRO on the project McWilliams is overseeing, which should be published before the end of this year.
We'll start off looking at 30 wells sampled to see what the kind of variations look like, and then we'll look at a subset of those wells in detail to see how they vary through time. The other approach that we're using in this study is using essentially far-field atmospheric methods. So what's possible to do is to look at the concentration, then try to backtrack using wind speeds and wind directions and what you know about meteorology in the local area. It's possible then to take those concentrations and try to link them to a source, be it a gas field. It could be a coal mine. It could be an agricultural source, say a feedlot, things like that, and as they change through time. So we're taking those two approaches as a first cut at advising the government on what those methane emissions look like as and how they vary through time.
Sources such as cattle, rubbish dumps, and wetlands can be identified by an isotopic analysis of the methane they produce. These younger sources will be rich in carbon isotopes like C13, whereas in coal seams, these isotopes would long have broken down into the more stable carbon-12. McWilliams is confident that most fugitive emissions related to coal seam gas operations are coming from the wellhead and pipeline infrastructure itself.
I believe that most of the issues of fugitive emissions produced by drilling and production and so on are technologically controllable to an order of magnitude that is less significant than other natural seeps.
But Southern Cross University researcher Damien Maher thinks drilling activity itself could be adding to fugitive emissions.
Our radon paper put forward a hypothesis that changes in the groundwater surface level coupled with changes in the geological structure through fracturing and drilling may actually enhance the flux from the coal seams to the atmosphere. We need to obviously do more work to actually quantify the relative importance of the infrastructure versus the soil leakages, and also whether these soil leakages are natural seeps or if they're induced by changes in the hydrology and geology due to development of coal seam gas fields.
While McWilliams doesn't like to speculate about what the final figure for fugitive emissions will be, he doesn't think it'll pass the threshold that would make methane a bigger greenhouse gas emitter than coal.
The bulk of the evidence at the moment still seems to suggest that the greenhouse warming produced by fugitive emissions of methane is still considerably larger for coal than it is for unconventional gas production. And this is really important to consider the entire life cycle from production through to transmission through to combustion.
Even if it doesn't reach that critical threshold, Santos says the figure is bound to rise from the current low estimates, with serious implications.
But it's very unlikely that the emission rates in Australia is going to go down. It's just so low that it's very unlikely to go down. If you are just missing those emissions, as some people suspect, we are essentially underestimating the country emissions and we are undercharging carbon tax to the coal seam gas mining companies.
But while they may disagree on estimates and methodology, nearly all the experts agree on one thing. It would have been much better to have been able to start this research and establish baselines before any drilling began. For The Science Show, I'm Peter Hadfield.
Thanks, Peter. Last week, we were slightly displaced by the Sydney Writers' Festival, and we heard on The Science Show once more a voyage around a 20th century willy. It's still there to hear in full, so do listen. And one distinguished listener was so moved by the perils of ownership of a penis and of the trials of the neglected spermatozoon that he wrote this lament for us to hear. Guy Noble.
It is a sad, sad fact that I sit waiting in the tract, hoping and wishing for the act that will propel me towards my fate. At the end of this hopeless date, I wait and wait and wait for the length of my natural term, an old decrepit sperm. My tail is tired and sore from swimming in circles forlorn. I hoped I would amount to more with the speed of an Olympic luge, to reach the fallopian tube and deposit my DNA to live another day. But instead I must cringe and squirm. An old decrepit sperm.
Guy Noble and his heartrending lament for a sperm, for which many thanks, Guy. He appears on ABC Classic FM, but not nearly enough. The Science Show is produced by Simon Branthwaite and David Fisher. Coming up next week, a forum about climate held at the University of New South Wales. And on ABC One, Catalyst is back with fire tornadoes, edible maggots and beguiling dogs. Do watch ABC One, 8 p.m. on Thursday. I'm Robin Williams. Woof.
On Background Briefing, the growing conflict over wind farms. Do the turbines make people sick?
Tinnitus, balance problems, dizziness, headaches, very vivid and quite violent dreams.
Or just think they're sick.
I mean, these claims are absolutely preposterous. They're fairy stories.
It's an ill wind that's splitting communities like King Island.
Yeah, my father's taken a view of these as going to save King Island. I don't know of any of his grandkids or his own kids that want these things.
You can download this background briefing from the RN website.